This is Crime Binge.
Welcome to Crime Binge,
the podcast,
where this week we are on episode 62, which is also part two of Richard Ramirez.
And last week, to remind you, we discussed his upbringing that made Ramirez who he was today and the beginning of his violent crimes. And today we'll continue tracing through his murders throughout Southern California. And it's a fucking trip, man.
Yeah. And just as a warning, this is solely a murder episode.
Yep. There's nothing else. We're
only going to be discussing his vicious murders. So if you just like the other portions, maybe skip episode two. But go back and listen to episode one, because we talk about his insane upbringing and all of the crazy shit, which was super fun. I don't know if fun is a great descriptor.
It was very interesting.
Yeah. But before we get into all of that, what are you binging this week, Sarah?
So this week I'm binging another podcast, because, you know, I've listened to a fucking million of them.
Do it up, girl.
And it's Radio Rental.
Yeah.
It's so good.
That one is very fun.
So it's created by Payne Lindsay, and the host is Rainn Wilson from The Office. And honestly, like, he doesn't fit into the, like, actual podcast at all. He's just a random host to, like, lighten it up.
Exactly, yeah.
And what the thing is, it's kind of similar to, like, the Let's Not Meet podcast, where people send in their stories of, like, these crazy encounters. But what's different about it is they actually, like, fly to the person and they interview them, and it's the person telling their own story.
Yeah.
And it's really cool. There's only 14 episodes, which kind of sucks, but, like, obviously it takes a long time to fly to each fucking person.
It's a very Payne Lindsay way of making a podcast. Like, I'm going to fly to each individual person. And he probably has, like, hours of recordings with each of those people. Yeah. And you get, like, a 15-minute story, which is super fun. Like, I do love Payne Lindsay. I think he's a great podcaster, but taking over the podcasting world, my friend.
Yeah. And, like, there is, like, probably three or four different stories per episode.
Yeah,
so
there are.
It's not like you only have 14 stories.
No. But each person, I feel like he probably spoke with them for hours. And
definitely,
we just, like, get 15 minutes of their story, which is so interesting to, like, what's on those other tapes?
Yeah. And then you have, like, a 10-second just Rainn Wilson being creepy as fuck.
Yeah, just talking about his radio, like, not radio, his
VHS,
rental store.
Yeah.
It's fun. And for, like, people who don't know what VHSs are, it's probably very confusing.
It's probably hilarious. But that is my binge.
Nice.
What are you binging this week?
I am binging a television show. It's called Wentworth.
Okay.
And it is basically Australia's version of Orange is the New Black.
Oh.
So it's, like, grittier, I guess I would describe it. Like, it's a lot more graphic in terms of murder and, like, the fights and stuff.
Okay.
It's very dramatic. It's almost like a, what are those?
Like, reality shows?
No. Like, Days of Our Lives. Soap operas.
Oh, okay.
It seems almost like a soap opera in, like, how dramatic it is. But my new roommates and I are just, like, watching it every single night. And we all just, like, randomly talk in Australian accents now. So it's been a great time. If you hear me slip into a really bad Australian accent, it's because of that.
I'm so excited.
Yeah, I did it on a team call the other day, and everyone was like, what are you doing? And I was like, I'm very sorry.
That's so funny.
How unprofessional of me. But yeah, it's super fun. It kind of drops off after the main character, or I perceived the main character to be, her name is B-E-A.
Okay.
And after she left the show, that's not a spoiler, she leaves the show just like Piper eventually left Orange is the New Black type thing. Did she? I never finished that show. I'm just making shit up now. But I don't know where I was going. Oh, it just kind of, like, fell off after that, but we're still finishing it out. We want to see what happens in Wentworth Prison, you know? Just crazy things. Yeah. Mystery.
And then afterwards, intrigue. You can finish Orange is the New Black.
Yeah, that is probably. I think we've already agreed to rewatch Gilmore Girls, but nice. It's a hard decision. Yeah. But yeah, that's what I am binging this week.
Also, since this is a podcast, no one can see this, but yeah. Morgan has dyed her hair pink. Oh, and yeah. So it's just, it's so different.
It is.
Because it's the first time I'm seeing it.
I know. And last week I was blonde.
Yeah.
And previously I just naturally had black hair. So
she's just going through the changes, but yeah. It's awesome. It looks great.
It is. It is. Wow. That's not what I meant. It's a change. I like it. I actually kind of liked the blonde better than the pink, but the pink is a vibe. The pink is fun. And I'm feeling it, you know?
Just I mean, working from home, you can do whatever the hell you want. Yeah. So why not?
Exactly. And everyone on my team, when they saw it, was like, super cute. 10 out of 10.
Nice.
Like, thank you, friends. So I'm really just becoming the gamer girl I want to be, but am not.
Okay.
Yeah,
I get it.
Yeah. Wow. I also am drinking a venti cold brew today, friends, so the reason I am manic is because of that. I just realized I'm being crazy.
Nah, you're good.
But
we do want to remind you guys again that we have a website now.
Oh, yeah.
And it's just crimebinge.com.
Yes,
and
check it out.
Awesome, yes.
We have pictures there from the cases, and then we also have our sources and all of that fun stuff. And you can submit your listener stories, which we would love to hear from you. They can be like true crime stories, I don't know, ghost stories.
Literally whatever you want.
Yeah, because it's almost Halloween, and we love ghost stories, and we liked doing our Halloween ghost story thing last year. So, whoa. I just knocked this entire table almost right over.
Just knocked it on me.
Yeah, I'm not used to recording at a table. Yeah. So now that we're recording at a table, I'm going to knock it over. Something's going to go down.
Yeah, there's been lots of changes.
Yeah.
We now have a table.
We have been going through it. Also, I feel like I should clarify last week. I said that I had a mental break. I didn't mean like I had a full-blown mental breakdown. I meant more that I needed a mental break from like everything.
Nah, you had a full-blown.
But I'm bad at words. So if you guys were like super concerned about me, I was okay. I just was going through it like everybody is going through it in 2020 and wanted a break.
Yeah.
I just realized that like editing it, I was like, wow, it sounds like you were hospitalized. Like you need to chill out. I am dramatic. We all know that about me, though. All right. That is enough of us chit-chatting. Would you like to get into part two of Richard Ramirez?
Let's fucking do it, man. So last week we left off with the last murder of Vincent and Maxine Zazaria.
Yes.
And so now we move forward to May 14th, 1985. So Richard, at this point, is living at the Cecil Hotel, and he leaves for the day to, you know, go have a day on the town, in his words.
Yeah.
So he went and shot some pool, went to a pornographic theater to see a nice show.
Quote unquote, nice show.
Yeah, right? And, like, I didn't realize that there are so many, like, pornographic theaters.
It used to be, like, a real thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't know that, and then like he's going to them all the time.
Yeah, that's how you used to get your porn. I'm pretty
instead
sure
of the internet.
Yeah. Which is I'm pretty sure what like Pee-wee Herman got in trouble for. It was like masturbating inside one of those theaters, which is like,
what's
isn't that the
for?
Whole purpose?
Yeah,
like why are we making these theaters if not to masturbate? Like,
exactly. Why would you go and specifically watch porn and just like blue ball yourself?
Yeah, like is it maybe it's that thing where you get yourself. We need to stop. We need to stop. My mom might listen to this. Never mind. If you listen and you work with me,
I'm sorry.
Forget that part. Wow. Let's go back to Richard Ramirez.
Yeah. So after all this, he's feeling all worked up and shit because he just went to a fucking pornographic theater.
Yeah.
and just decides to go on a murdering spree.
Like any good criminal, I guess. Yeah, any good Satanist, as yeah. Richard would put it.
So he began driving around like usual, listening to AC/DC, and he eventually returned to Monterey Park, where he had previously killed Veronica. He pulls up to the house of Bill and Lillian Doy. Bill was a 66-year-old man, and the day before this happened, he'd just put a payment down on a new Ford van to travel the country with his wife.
Yeah.
And Lillian was 56 years old, and she was disabled, needing a wheelchair to get around. Some sources said she had cerebral palsy, but mm-hmm. not all of them said it. But she was really looking forward to this trip around the country together.
Yeah, like Bill had just retired, basically, so they could travel the world, not the world, but the U.S. together in like their little van. Yeah. And fucking Richard Ramirez had to come and shit on it because he's a terrible person.
Yes. So Richard gets to the house and makes his way into the backyard. And he noticed that the windows had alarms on them. But he did see that one of the windows had been left open with only a screen separating him from the house. He was able to remove the screen and enter the home, coming in through the bathroom. When he started moving throughout the home, he actually saw Lillian first, asleep in bed, but just decided to go to Bill first. And since Lillian was disabled, she actually slept in her own room in a hospital bed.
Yeah, I think, like, in case Bill needed to, like, check on her and move her and stuff, yeah. Which makes sense.
And also, like, Bill himself wouldn't want to sleep in a hospital bed all the time, you know?
Yeah.
And Bill had actually heard Richard moving around throughout the house, and he went to grab his gun, but was too late. Richard used his .22 to shoot Bill in the face right above his lip. He attempted to shoot Bill a second time, but the gun jammed. So, being the super violent guy he was, Richard just physically beat Bill into unconsciousness.
Yeah.
Lillian was woken up by the gunshot, but, being disabled, was unable to move to get out of bed, so she basically just had to lie there and listen to what she could only presume to be her husband being murdered.
Which is terrible.
Yes. Richard then made his way into Lillian's room and slapped her in the face, telling her that he would kill her if she screamed. And he also bound her with thumb cuffs. Which, like, he uses thumb cuffs a lot, and it's just an interesting thing.
Yeah. Just the idea of a thumb cuff is very silly to me.
Like, why? Why wouldn't you use handcuffs? Because yeah. I feel like they'd be a lot more, like, restraining than thumb
yeah.
cuffs.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not sure.
I don't know. It's weird. So
it's a specific thumb cuff kink, I guess. I don't apparently. Know.
So Richard then began to ransack the house, taking a lot of sentimental jewelry. While doing this, Bill woke up, and Richard noticed this, beat him into unconsciousness again.
Yeah.
After this, Richard went into Lillian's room again, and this time he raped her. When he was done, he simply placed all of the stolen items into two pillowcases and left the residence, leaving Lillian alive.
Also alone.
Yeah.
Truthfully.
After he was gone, Bill actually came to again and managed to crawl into the other room to check on his wife.
Incredible, right? Honestly.
And he was like 66 years old.
Yeah.
He was able to get to a phone and call 911, but he was only able to whisper into the phone, "Help me," before passing out again.
Yeah.
Shortly after, he woke up again and called the police for a second time, begging for help. And the operator told him that police were on their way.
Yeah.
When the police arrived, their investigation immediately starts. Lillian was able to describe to the police what the attacker looked like, specifically his bad teeth. And Bill was immediately taken to the hospital in an ambulance and admitted to the ICU. But he unfortunately died while he was there, and his time of death was 5:29 a.m. And it's, like, so sad because he went through so much, like, yeah. to get his wife help. And mm-hmm. if he hadn't have woken up and had died at the scene, like, she would have died because there was nothing she could do.
Yeah, she wouldn't have gotten help. It's very sad. Yes. Like, all of these cases obviously are very sad, but there's so many in, like, Richard Ramirez where they're, like, able to fight back and mm-hmm. it's just, like, not enough because some unfortunate circumstance yes. has, like, really fucked them over. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? They're all just so close and then something happens and it's just, it's like a movie almost, like, all of his crimes. And I wonder if it actually occurred like that, you know?
Right.
Because we only know it from his point of view.
Yeah, that's true.
So maybe it didn't actually happen like it and it's not as movie-like as we think.
And it's like he almost got caught so many times.
Yeah.
Like, and he just got away by the fucking skin on his teeth.
Yeah.
Again, Detective Carrillo began asking about this case as he believed it was related to the cases he was already investigating.
Yeah.
This guy's on top of it.
He really is.
But the police in Monterey Park were very unhelpful, and as they saw it, they didn't want him snooping around in their investigation.
If I could take all of the cops in the 70s, specifically in California, and LAPD. Just shake them up really hard and then put them back down and be like, hey, stop it. I feel like
it would help.
It would have helped. You know, I don't know that to be true, but I feel like it could have been a preventative measure.
I get it.
Much like I think if I took my spine out and shook it around and put it back in, my back would feel better.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. I just wanted to give the podcast context for how my brain works. Okay. So the next crime actually took place against Ma Bell Bell, who went by Ma, or Ma Bell, not Mabel. I'm sorry. Her name's Mabel, right?
Yes, her yeah. name is Mabel, but she goes by Ma, and her last name's Bell, yeah. so people say Ma or Ma Bell, and it's fucking
it's
stupid.
It's very confusing.
It is, because Maybell's such a pretty name, and Ma Bell is such a bad name.
Well, it's just, it doesn't make any sense to me, because her name's already Mabel.
Yes.
And her last name is Bell.
Yeah.
So, like, why?
We're just gonna call her Ma.
Yeah, we are just gonna call her Ma. But she was 83. And her sister, Florence Lane, who went by Nettie, was 81. And they lived together in Monrovia, California. And just so you know, if you look up this murder, it's very strange. There are actually, on different sources, two completely different names for this group of sisters. Or this yeah. pairing of sisters,
because,
rather.
Like, the crimes are the exact same, but the names are different.
Yeah.
So we went with the names from the book that we've been using as a source. Because yeah. he actually talked to the investigators and to Richard and everything.
Yeah. So, but just in case, the other names are Malville Keller and Blanche Wolfe. Blanche. Not Blanche. I don't know what I'm saying. Blanche Wolfe.
Blanche
Am I
is
okay?
the fancy version.
Yeah. Blanche is like what you do to vegetables.
No, right? That's Blanche.
Oh, yeah. You're right. Wow. Okay. It sounds like we're making fun of murder victims, and we're not.
We're just making fun of the fact that we can't pronounce names.
Yeah. Like, we're just terrible at reading names, apparently.
Yes.
Okay. So Ma was described, even into her 80s, as a strong, independent woman who did not need no man.
Hell yeah.
She was a widow who raised two children by herself. And as she got older, she eventually had 12 grandchildren.
That's six kids per kid.
Yeah, and we don't even know if that's how it worked out.
I know.
And Ma Bell actually had taken in her sister 2 years earlier, as she didn't want her to be institutionalized because Nettie was also disabled in some way, physically, I believe. And let's see. Okay. These sisters, because they're in their 80s and the 70s.
Yeah.
You know, like, just keep that in mind.
Everything is good in their heads.
Yeah. So they slept with their doors unlocked, as they did live in a relatively isolated area that had a really low crime rate. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you live out in the middle of nowhere, people are less likely to come out there, you know? That's yeah, what they're like, thinking.
I read that, like, the neighbors were, like, almost a block away. Like, they had a big piece of property.
Right. So Ma's children always tried to convince her to lock her doors. But she said that she saw the good in people and didn't want to live like that, behind locked doors. So on May 29th, 1985, Richard somehow found his way up the windy road of Alta Vista, and the first house he came upon was Mabel's. He pulled up to the house at around 11:30 a.m. and was driving a gray Mercedes that he had stolen. Richard walked up to the house and tried the front door, and it was unlocked. When exploring the house, he realized that there wasn't much that he could steal as the sisters were not well off, and this made him angry, which he does this a lot. And it's like, maybe read the room, bro, and like look at the outside of the fucking house and like look inside the windows first. I don't know. It sounds like you're using it as an excuse to murder and not actually just rob people.
Oh, 100%.
Once he was in the house, he went to the kitchen to find a knife to use on the women. But when he couldn't find one that he deemed sharp enough, he grabbed a hammer instead that he found. He took this hammer to Florence's room and struck her in the head repeatedly. He bound her hands behind her back with electrical cord and then went to Ma's room and struck her in the head with the hammer. She woke up screaming, but he told her to shut up or he'd kill her, and demanded to know where the money and jewelry was. When she said that there was no money, he struck her again with the hammer. He found duct tape and bound her feet together with it, and then shocked Ma by pulling out electrical wire from an alarm clock and touching her with the exposed wire.
Which is just such a fucked up thing. Like,
how
do you even think of that?
Well, like, my thing is Richard thinks he's, like, so cool, like, that he's murdering people, and it's like, you're breaking in specifically to, like, elderly people's homes and children. Like, obviously you're not as great as you think you are. Like, you're taking advantage of people who are weaker than you for, like,
And doing it in the middle of the night where they're not expecting it and can't fight back.
And no one actually knows how long he tortured her like this for, because he was just a real shitbag with this with this group of sisters. He then took anything he could find, which consisted of some costume jewelry, watches, and a cassette player. With his emotions running high, Richard returned to Florence's room and ripped off her nightgown and raped her. While doing this, Richard said that he thought of Satan and how Satan would be proud of him.
Which, like, not true, motherfucker.
Yeah, it's just not. He wanted the world to know what he stood for, so he took Ma's red lipstick and used it to draw a pentagram on the back of her left thigh and on the wall above her head in her in Florence's room. Then he went into the kitchen, ate a banana, drank a can of Mountain Dew and Coke, peed in their toilet, and didn't flush it like the true moron he is, and then just left.
Yeah. So on May 30th, the next morning, Ma's gardener, who had known her for over two decades, came and knocked on the door with no answer. So he came back the next morning to no answer again, and returned for a third time and saw that two newspapers had not been picked up. He got concerned and just entered the house calling out for Ma and her sister. He found Florence laying in her bed where she had been left 58 hours earlier, with her eyes open and her head caked in blood. Her hands were still bound behind her, and this gardener thought that she was dead.
Yeah, I think anyone would assume that.
Oh, yeah. So he ran out of the house and drove to their neighbor's house, who then called the police. And again, the fire department arrived before the police at 11:50 a.m. The first responders found Ma first, and they cut the tape binding her ankles and started giving her CPR. The first responders noticed brain matter coming out of the left side of her head above her ear, and she was alive, but she was in a coma. Florence was found next. The bindings on her hands had caused her hands to swell up, and she was also comatose. The sisters were taken to the hospital, and each woman had multiple skull fractures with brain matter visible. And it was noted that Florence had also been sexually assaulted. The police decided that even though there was not a murder, the attack had been so gruesome that they contacted the sheriff's homicide department. Two half-eaten bananas and empty cans of Coke and Mountain Dew were collected for evidence. There was also a bloody footprint in the house. And since there was no knife or gun used, this crime was not attributed to the man in black from the previous attacks. And also, a pentagram had never been left behind before. So, when detectives went to see if they could interview the women at the hospital, they entered Florence's room, and she just, like, turned away from them, moaning in fear, and did not want anything to do with anyone.
Yeah.
And Mabel Bell later died at the hospital from her injuries on July 17th, and the cause of her death was massive brain trauma. So she lasted, like, over a month.
Yeah, which is insane, honestly.
Yeah.
From all of that trauma. So, the evening after attacking the sisters, May 30th, Richard, feeling very sexually motivated, went out hunting again. I hate that he calls it hunting. It just makes me roll my eyes so fucking hard. He went out to Burbank armed with handcuffs, a 25 automatic handgun, and his trusty 22. He parked on North Avon at 3:57 a.m. and walked up to a beige house. He walked to the backyard and realized that all of the doors and windows were locked. However, he spotted a doggy door, which he reached inside of and was able to unlock the back door this way. Fun fact, when I would leave my key at home as a teenager, I would get into our house through the doggy door.
Nice.
But I would just crawl through the doggy door.
Yeah, like he was skinny enough, it would have just been easier to do that, I feel like.
I wonder if it just would have made too much noise in his mind. I'm not sure. But make sure your doggy door is small. I'm just kidding.
And also, like, because he does this multiple times, but there's never any talk about if there's an actual dog in the house.
Yeah. I mean, if you have a doggy door, I would assume you would have a dog, or you would lock the doggy door. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That just feels like a way to invite raccoons, at least, into your house. 100%. You know what I mean? There were several times where we woke up to little bandits inside our house.
What?
Yeah. My stepmom, like, literally thought that people were breaking into our house and there was a fucking, like, raccoon in our kitchen because it had gotten in through the doggy door to eat food.
That's fucking hilarious.
Yeah. Like, it happened multiple occasions, and then we were like, we have to lock the doggy door at night.
Yeah.
All right. Random tangent, so sorry. So, after getting into the beige house, he walked around with his gun drawn and found his way into the bedroom of 42-year-old Carol Kyle, who was sleeping in her bed. Richard shined the penlight he was using to see in Carol's eyes, and he shook her and screamed, "Wake up, bitch. Don't scream or I'll kill you. Don't make a fucking sound," all while putting a gun to her head. He made Carol walk him to her 11-year-old son, Mark's room, and he was the only other person home. When they got to the room, he made Carol lay on the ground, and he opened the door to the boy's bedroom, leaping onto the bed and holding the gun to his head, again saying, "Don't fucking move, don't look at me, and don't move." Carol got up and ran into the room, putting herself in between her son and Richard, saying, "Take whatever you want, just don't hurt the boy." And I feel like Richard was not expecting, like, to have an 11-year-old boy in the house when this happened. Because you'll see later, but he just is, like, so confusing during this attack. Yes. I think, like, even more manic than he normally is. Richard handcuffed the boy and Carol together and put them in the closet. He decided that this wasn't a good idea, so he laid them on the bed in Carol's room and then covered them with a sheet before he started ransacking the house. After a while, he panics again and puts them back in the closet and continues to go through the house.
Yeah, and, like, I think that he's just going back and forth because he's panicking and not knowing what the best thing to do is.
So he eventually goes back to the closet and uncuffs Carol and cuffs both of Mark's hands behind his back and left him in the closet. He then dragged Carol back to her room by her hair and is, like, demanding to know where the jewelry is. Carol ended up giving him a teardrop-shaped diamond necklace that was actually made from her engagement ring. And she had this made into a necklace after her husband died.
Yeah.
Like, Carol is honestly incredible, by the way.
She is.
And at this point, Carol, who was a nurse, knew that she had to stay calm. She told him to take whatever he wanted and just to not hurt her children. And at this point, this caused Richard to pause, and he said, children?
Yeah,
plural?
Not just child.
Poor Kay?
Yeah.
And he's like, is there someone else here? And Carol says that she has a daughter, but she was away at a sleepover. Richard then pushes her down on the bed, ties her hands behind her back with a pair of pantyhose, puts a pillow over her head, and finishes searching the bedroom.
So when he's done searching the bedroom and ransacking, he rips off Carol's nightgown and underwear and unzips his pants, makes her perform oral sex on him. And in an attempt to save herself from being raped, she said that she was on her period and she had a disease. And he just told her to stop talking. So she did.
Yeah.
Which, like, that's what I would think. Like,
yeah.
If something like that was happening, I'd just be like, I need to be as gross as possible to this
person.
Yeah. So from here on out, Carol just followed along in an effort to save her life and her family.
Yeah.
So Richard then sodomized her twice. And then just casually went into the kitchen to get himself a drink.
Because he is the epitome of a trash human.
Mm-hmm. And when he returned, this part pissed me off so
yeah,
much.
This part, like, makes me ragey.
So when he returned, he told Carol that she was pretty good sexually for her age.
Bitch, she's in her 40s. What? Like, your vagina doesn't fall off after the age of 30. Shut the fuck up, Richard. Sorry, he just, like, annoys the shit out of me.
That was the funniest thing. So, Carol, not wanting to anger him or anything, just said thank you, which is something I don't think I'd have.
Yeah, I think at that point I would just be like, okay, listen here.
Yeah.
Not really, but yeah, she is perfect in this scenario. Mm-hmm. Scenario?
Scenario.
Okay.
So, before Richard leaves the house, he asks Carol for directions on how to get to the highway, and when she tells him, he acts confused because he thought he was in Glendale, not in Burbank. So, he's just, like, fucking, he's panicky here.
Yeah. From the start, yeah. This was a bad move.
So, he told Carol he was going to bring Mark into the room, so she asked if she could get dressed first because she didn't want her son to see her like that.
Yeah.
And actually, to her surprise, Richard, like, showed some kindness, untied one of her hands, and gave her a new nightgown before bringing Mark into the room.
Which is very shocking. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he has, like, a few moments of just, like,
humanity,
yeah,
almost.
Yeah, and it's weird.
It is, because his whole thing is just, like, degrading people. Mm-hmm. So you would think, like, let's fucking degrade her even more. But
yeah.
He didn't, which is interesting.
So he handcuffed them both to the headboard of her bed and placed the key on the mantle so her 16-year-old daughter could unlock them when she came home from the sleepover.
Yeah.
On his way out, Richard told Carol not to tell the police what he looked like because, like, he obviously knew she was going to call the police.
Right.
And he told her to tell the police that he was wearing a mask and didn't see what he looked like. So after Carol heard Richard leave, which was just before dawn, Mark was able to reach the phone and dial 911. Two officers showed up to their house, and when they pulled up, they could see Mark waving from the bedroom window. The front door was locked, so they went around back to find that the back door was, like, unlocked and it was open.
Mm-hmm.
The officers entered the house and found Carol and Mark. After unlocking the handcuffs with the key that Richard had left behind, they took Carol to the hospital for a rape screening. Mark was unharmed, and he stayed at the house with his older sister who arrived and another officer.
Yeah.
The next day, Carol worked with a sketch artist to try and make a composite of her attacker, but she wasn't really satisfied with the outcome of it. But she described him as being kind of attractive and said that he smelled like wet leather.
Not a great descriptor.
No, not at all.
Not what you want to be described as. Okay, so The next house he stopped at was, again, in Monterey Park. He liked Monterey Park for some reason.
He did. That was, like, the most frequent place yeah. he went.
This home belonged to 66-year-old Harold Wu and 63-year-old Jean Wu. And he broke into their house and shot Harold in the head. And Harold actually would initially survive the attack, but would later die in the hospital due to his injuries, much like a lot of his victims. Jean was bound, violently attacked, and then raped. He left her alive and later said that he got a sense of feeling like God whenever he chose to keep someone alive, like he saved them.
Yeah.
Okay. And Jean would also go on to tell police that the man who attacked her was tall, gaunt, dark, and Hispanic. On June 2nd, 1985, 29-year-old Edward Wildgins was killed by Ramirez by being shot in the temple with a small caliber gun. His girlfriend was violently raped but was able to fight him off. This was another case that actually wasn't connected to him until the late 2000s. After this, Richard went out hunting again with a stolen Toyota in early June. He stopped the car in front of a house in Pico Rivera belonging to John and Susan Rodriguez. John was actually a Los Angeles sheriff's deputy and slept with his revolver in the nightstand next to his bed. He had gone to sleep, but Susan stayed up to watch the 11:30 p.m. news and had dozed off on the couch. Richard walked up to the house and tried the front door and windows, but they were all locked. He ended up finding an unlocked dining room window on the side of the house.
Please make sure all of your windows are locked. Like, don't just lock the front ones.
Yeah, I think it's like one of those things where you're like, it's a nice day out, and you let the window open mm-hmm. and you forget to like lock it when you're done type yeah. of thing. You know what I mean? The sound of the window opening actually woke Susan up, and she called out to her husband asking if that was him opening the window. John woke up from the sound of his wife's voice and entered the living room. With the element of surprise gone and both people in the house awake, Richard decided that the best thing to do was just to leave, which is the smartest thing he's ever done.
Exactly.
But he did leave a shoe print under the window, which is like his calling card at this point, honestly, yeah. which John saw and called in the attempted break-in because he's a fucking cop.
Yeah.
And the police realized that this print actually matched the others from the previous murders. So Carrillo wasn't looking so fucking crazy now.
Right.
And Carrillo actually did race to the scene. And he confirmed that the print belonged to Distinctive Avia Shoes. Avia?
Avia.
Avia. Distinctive Avia Shoes. They did a plaster of the shoe print, and Carrillo went inside to interview Susan and John. Susan said that God must have been looking over them that night, and John said that he would have killed him if the man had gotten into his house. Which, like, yeah, that yeah. officer would have shot you. Oh, sorry, yeah. Richard.
So Richard was angry that his plan was ruined and just continued to hunt. And he even kept hunting until the sun was up. In Eagle Rock, he attempted to abduct a little girl, but she screamed and got away. And a neighbor saw this happening and called 911. While he was fleeing, Richard ran a red light and was spotted by a motorcycle cop. As the cop turned on his lights and began to give chase, Richard entered the freeway. While on the freeway, he threw a gun and an ounce of pot out the window and the officer didn't see it.
Wild.
And this part is like the craziest to me. Richard eventually pulled over, and the cop thought like that the only thing he could get him on was a stolen vehicle.
Yeah.
And Richard told the officer he left his wallet at home, so he didn't have his license and registration. And the officer made him get out of the car, put his hands on the front hood. Richard gave the officer a fake name and address, and the officer went back to the motorcycle to call it in. While he was there, he heard about the attempted abduction over the radio with a detailed description of the car and suspect, which he had right there.
Yeah.
But the officer didn't realize this was the guy who he had just pulled over, but Richard overheard it, and he was like, I gotta go.
Yeah,
I gotta
he's run. Like, of course this guy is gonna put two yeah. and two together. I've gotta run.
So the officer comes back to Richard and says, hey, you're not the guy killing all these people, are you? And Richard goes, no way. When are you guys going to catch that motherfucker? The officer says, we'll get him. Like,
yeah,
I hate it. So the officer started walking back to his motorcycle. Richard said a prayer to Satan.
I hate him.
And in some places I saw that before he did that, he drew a pentagram on the hood of the car.
Okay.
And just fucking took off running as fast as he could. The officer tried chasing him on his motorcycle, but Richard, like, ran through yards and alleyways, jumped fences, and just managed to hop on a bus and get away.
Fair enough.
In the movies.
Yeah, it really is. Also, I want to know if that conversation actually happened.
Right.
Like, I would love to be a fly on the wall.
So, back to the sheriff's office. When Carrillo saw his lieutenant, he told him about the shoe print they found at Rodriguez's home and that their killer was still out there and tried to strike again. His lieutenant didn't believe him and that it was the same guy and told him that the individual police stations would handle it. Carrillo then went and told Frank Salerno about his findings. The two men approached their captain, Captain Grimm.
A great name. Sorry, have to interrupt for that.
And told him about the print in Pico. The two men then went to the Northeastern LA department where the attempted abduction took place. They asked to see the stolen car the suspect had been driving, and the Northeastern LAPD told them no.
Yeah.
That they had to jump through hoops of going through higher-ups in order to see evidence from their jurisdiction. So frustrated, Carrillo and Salerno went back to Captain Grimm and told him what happened. Captain Grimm's pissed, and he picks up the phone, and he's like, well, if we can't do that, we're going to start finding out about the Avia sneakers. And this is really when Carrillo and Salerno started working together as a team.
We're trying to nail this guy down.
Exactly, when no one else really is.
Yeah. So, on July 2nd, 1985, Richard went for a drive to Arcadia, California, which is about 13 miles northeast of Los Angeles City. He had parked a few blocks away from the freeway and started walking down the street of the neighborhood, scanning for houses he thought seemed vulnerable. He stopped at the home of 75-year-old Mary Louise Cannon, who lived alone. He chose this house because all of the lights were off and there was only one car in the driveway. Mary had previously had cancer twice, but beat it both times. She was also described as a strong, independent woman, and she had five grandchildren and was excited for a trip to Australia with her senior citizens group in a few weeks.
So she's just living her best life.
Yeah, like, all of these people are, like, retired and finally gonna fucking live their dream and just don't get to do it because of Richard.
Yeah.
And it's just frustrating. I hate him. Richard walked to the right front window of the house, removed the screen, and opened the window. He made his way inside and started walking back towards the house and discovered that Mary was alone and was angry that there was no young woman in the house. There's never a young woman in the house.
I know.
Like, why are you angry now?
He, like, goes to all these old neighborhoods.
Yeah. He spotted a heavy lamp on the dresser in her bedroom and used it to bash Mary in the head. She woke up screaming, and he choked her and beat her into unconsciousness. He then found a sharp 10-inch butcher's knife in the kitchen and used it to stab Mary. He stabbed her repeatedly. After he was done, he ransacked the house and left out the front door. Mary's neighbors, Christine and Frank, had lived next to Mary for 25 years. They went out to the house that morning to work in their garden, and Christine noticed that the window screen was laying on Mary's lawn. So Frank, being neighborly, put the screen back in the window for her, noticing that the latch had been bent forward. He actually had to use a hammer to hit it back into place, and he thought that it was really weird that Mary didn't come out to even see what the noise was.
Yeah, like someone's pounding on your house.
Yeah, you would expect at least, like, a little peek out the window.
Yeah.
And they also noticed that her paper had not been picked up, which is very unusual. And so they decided to check on Mary using a key that Mary had given to them for emergencies. And I guarantee you these people were just like, it's an elderly neighbor. She probably fell. You exactly. know what I mean? It's never the horror scene they're about to walk into.
Oh, yeah.
They entered her house, and when Mary didn't answer their calls, they looked around and noticed that the place had been ransacked. They decided to leave the house and call the police before going any further, which I think is a blessing.
Yeah.
Arcadia officer Ed Winter was at the house very quickly. Frank explained to him the situation before he went inside, and Officer Ed and Frank actually went in the house together. Officer Winter discovered Mary and immediately knew that she was dead. He quickly got Christine and Frank out of the home in order to preserve the scene and called homicide, which, good on him, because this was a time when they were like, nah, everyone, yeah. just come on through this scene.
Exactly.
So Salerno and Carrillo drove down together to Mary's house to check out the scene. They discovered footprints in Mary's rug that looked similar to the other murders. And when they returned to the station, Salerno decided that he was going to go to Captain Grimm, and they were Grimm, not Grin, Captain Grimm, and they were going to start a task force dedicated to catching the serial killer. Grimm gave Salerno the go-ahead, and he was asked to head this task force. He selected a few men that he knew and trusted, and they got to getting.
Yeah, because remember, he was like one of the top people of catching the Hillside Strangler.
Yeah.
So, Richard decided to alter his appearance the next time he went out. He slicked his hair back and wore white framed glasses.
He knew it was getting a little hot.
Yeah. He drove to Sierra Madre on July 5th in yet another stolen car that he had only stolen just a few hours earlier. He heard over his police scanner that he had with him that the police were on the lookout for him, but he decided not to leave the wealthy area.
Yeah.
He eventually stopped on a quiet street and made his way to an all-white farm-style house. He discovered that the front door was open and entered the home of Mr. and Mrs. Steve Bennett and their two children, 16-year-old Whitney and 18-year-old James.
This is like the first time there's a young girl in the house.
Mm-hmm. Using a pen light to see in the dark house, he made his way to the right where he found Whitney's bedroom. He entered the room and saw her sleeping. He took the jewelry off her dresser and left the bedroom and made his way to the back of the house where he found the bedroom of Steve and his wife Anna. And they were both asleep. And so Richard leaves the house for a minute and goes back to the car and got a tire iron, deciding not to use the gun.
Yeah, because it would be too loud.
Yeah, there's too many people to overtake.
Yeah.
So he returned to Whitney's room and struck her with the tire iron, knocking her unconscious. He then proceeded to strike her with it 10 more times. He decided that he wanted to kill her using a knife as it was more personal to him. He went into the kitchen in search of a knife, but couldn't find the exact one he wanted.
I hate him.
Yes. He returned to Whitney's room and decided to strangle her with the telephone cord. So he started strangling her with the wire. But the wire started, like, sparking, and this caused him to hesitate for a second and let go of the cord, and Whitney suddenly gasped for air. This, like, freaked him out, and he left the house. He thought to himself that it was the power of Christ that had intercepted and saved her life.
Fair enough.
Mm-hmm. When he was in the house, he had wanted to rape her. Not having the chance to before he left, he was still very sexually charged. He found a sex worker, and when he told her that he wanted to have sex with her feet, she just laughed in his face, so he threw her out of the car. At 5:45 that morning, Whitney woke up with a painful headache. She had no memory of the attack and was shocked to see all of the blood. She collapsed at her doorway and started screaming for her father. He got out of bed and saw his daughter beaten and covered in blood. Like, imagine that shock value.
Yeah, first, like, imagine waking up with a very bad headache and, like, then turning and your bed is covered in fucking blood, and then you, like, wake up and you see your daughter covered in blood. Yeah. Like, what? That's horrifying.
It is. And her father also saw the bloody tire iron that had been left behind, and he immediately called the police.
Yeah.
Detectives Salerno and Carrillo made it to the house of the attack, and Carrillo later said it was one of the bloodiest crime scenes I'd ever been at.
Which is horrible.
Mm-hmm. But there was no evidence of the things that their killer used, like a gun or knife or handcuffs. But because of the brutality of the crime, they suspected it was him.
Yeah.
One of the criminalists collecting evidence at the scene eventually pulled back the comforter to Whitney's bed and discovered the distinct print of the Avia's shoe.
Mm-hmm.
And this is when they were certain it was the same guy. They drove to the hospital where Whitney had been taken in order to interview her, but when they got there, she was still unconscious. She had to have her head shaved, and they could see the damage. The doctor believed that she had been struck at least 20 times. The doctor said she would live, but it required 478 stitches to close the lacerations in her head.
Yeah, that's wild.
The detectives returned to the hospital the next day, and Whitney was awake and up for talking. She recounted her evening to them, but couldn't remember anything of the attack and saying she never even saw her attacker.
So on July 7th, Richard drove around, making his way back to Monterey Park. He stopped in front of 61-year-old Joyce Lucille Nelson's house and entered through an unlocked window, leaving a ton of footprints outside. Joyce had worked in the production line of an envelope company for the last 33 years and was planning on retiring soon. She was divorced and lived alone, and when Richard entered the home, he found her asleep on the couch in front of the TV. He placed his gun to her head and woke her up. She tried to resist him when he started dragging her to the bedroom, and he hit her, knocking her down, and proceeded to beat her until she was unconscious. He dragged her unconscious body back into the bedroom, where he proceeded to beat her and kick her until she died. He had kicked her so hard that there was an imprint of his Avia shoe in her face because he's a fucking terrible person. He ransacked the house, taking the VCR, jewelry, and anything of value, and then just left through the front door. After leaving Joyce's house, Richard drove around some more, and at around 3 a.m., he stopped in front of the home of 63-year-old psychiatric nurse Sophie Dickman. He broke into the house by reaching in through a doggy door and found Sophie sleeping in her bed. He turned on all of the lights and rushes towards her. He put the gun to her head and covered her mouth. He then handcuffed Sophie, and she tried to remain as calm as she could, knowing that this was the man breaking into people's houses and killing them, and that she shouldn't anger him. He put a pillowcase over her head and made her sit on the floor of the bathroom. He ransacked the house and quickly returned to Sophie, asking her where the diamonds and money were. She directed him to a hiding spot in the other bathroom, and he dragged her back into the bedroom where he tried to sodomize her but couldn't get an erection. Richard then handcuffed her to the bed and made her swear on Satan that there were no other valuables in the house. He collected all of his findings in a pillowcase and left, warning her not to scream or he would come back and kill her. When Sophie knew the intruder was gone, she pushed the bed to the window where she used her feet to open the window and started screaming for her neighbor, Linda Arthur, who was in law enforcement and had actually worked the Doy case just 2 months prior. The calls woke Linda up and she went across the street to Sophie's window. Sophie apologized to her for waking her up and told her what happened, which, like, literally me.
Yeah, like, I'm sorry to wake you, yeah. But I was just attacked.
Yeah. Linda ran back to her house and called 911. And Linda actually called her friend, Gil Carrillo, and said she believed it was his guy, and he sped to the scene right away. Sophie was already at the hospital by the time he got there. The Monterey police were already there, and after some time, they let Carrillo view the crime scene, which was nice of them because mm-hmm. they're typically hoes about it. And there were the typical signs of the intruders, the handcuffs and disabled phones, but there were no Avia footprints, so he couldn't be totally sure. Shortly after 10 a.m., he got the call about Joyce Nelson's murder and that the Avia print had been found there. The media got to Nelson's residence before Carrillo could, and this was the first time that the media was reporting on the presence of a serial killer, as the Monterey Park police were finally acknowledging it themselves. Carrillo and Salerno were also finally welcomed to the scene, as they had been saying it was a serial killer the whole time.
Yeah.
With this new media frenzy, people were going crazy trying to protect themselves, buying alarm systems, guard dogs, and guns. This is also when the press finally dubbed the killer the Night Stalker. And at this point, I'm pretty sure the police didn't want the media to know that there was a serial killer yet, because they wanted to release like a full-blown statement about it. But you know the media.
Yeah, right.
They got there before.
So the task force had also done some research on the Avia shoe. And they found out that only 6 of the specific shoe were sold in the LA area, and only one of those was a size 11.5. So this confirmed to them that it was only one killer doing all of the murders.
But also, think about how many people fucking live in LA. Only 6 of that shoe had been sold.
They must have been ugly as fuck.
They probably were. I've never even heard of Avia, to be honest.
Yeah, me either.
So
then Carrillo and Salerno went to visit Sophie Dickman at her home as she was released from the hospital. She described her attacker as being white, tall, skinny, dressed in black, having bad teeth, and good looking. The LAPD finally let Carrillo and Salerno have access to the car that they had taken in when the police pulled Richard over before and he ran away.
Nice.
Inside, they found a wallet with a card for a dentist's office, as well as a little black book with 6 phone numbers in it. So they go to the dentist and found out that Richard had gone there under an alias on July 3rd. And he had many abscesses in his mouth.
Yeah.
And was in like a lot of pain. So he was sure to be back. Like, he had to get shit done to his teeth.
Right.
So the police set up undercover agents to stay at the dentist's office. On July 20th, Richard went into a knife store and bought a machete. He got into a new stolen Toyota and headed north to Glendale. He stopped the car and made his way to the home of Leela and Max in Knighting. Leela and Max were high school sweethearts. They had 3 children and 13 grandchildren, which again, so many. Max owned a service station and Leela worked for the security force at a department store. All of their windows were locked, but he managed to get inside of the house by cutting the screen of a French door and reaching in to unlock the lock. Before entering the house, he got down on his knees and prayed to Satan. So fucking dramatic.
I hate him.
I know. He then entered the house carrying the machete he had bought earlier. After checking out the house, he entered their bedroom, turned on the lights, kicked their bed, and said, "Rise and shine, motherfuckers." The couple shot up in bed, and Richard just immediately swung the machete, hitting Max in the neck. And he was shocked that the machete was not sharp enough to just immediately decapitate him. And so Richard pulled out his .22 and shot Max in the head, killing him instantly. Which, honestly, probably better, because instant death, like...
No, the machete is awful.
Yeah. Leela screamed, and Richard shot her in the face 3 times, killing her. Like, this is such a, like, frantic murder compared to all of the other ones.
Yeah, I think he's scared because the media, like, has a name for him now.
So, after he killed Leela, he then mutilated their bodies with the machete and ransacked the house. He heard over his police scanner that there was a report of shots fired, so he quickly left the house and fenced the stolen belongings. Later that morning, Leela and Max's daughter Judy called them, but no one answered. And they typically had Saturday breakfast together before church, And when her parents weren't at the breakfast place or church, she decided to stop by their house. She found her parents' bodies in the bedroom after noticing the ransacking in the house. She called the police, who immediately started an investigation, but they didn't contact the sheriff's office, and Creo didn't know about it until he just happened to talk to the coroner the next day.
Yeah. So after the attack on Leela and Max, Richard drove even further north to Sun Valley. At 4:15 a.m., he stopped on a dark street and started walking, leaving the machete in the car. He stopped in front of the home of Chainarong and Somkid Kovanoff. Somkid Kovanoff. The couple were immigrants from Thailand who came to Los Angeles 10 years earlier. He worked as a parking attendant, and him and his wife had two children, an 8-year-old boy and a 2-year-old girl. Richard managed to get into the house through sliding glass doors in the back of the house that were open. Somkid was sleeping on the couch and woke up when Richard entered. He put his hand over her mouth and the gun to her head to silence her. He saw the children sleeping in their own rooms and then found Chainarong sleeping in bed. Richard then shot him in the head, killing him instantly. He then returned to Somkid, took her wedding ring, slapped her, and ripped off her nightgown. He dragged her into the bathroom and used a knife to cut the cord of a hairdryer and tied her hands behind her back, and then he raped her. An alarm clock in the 8-year-old's room went off, and Richard ran to the boy's room where he tied him up and put a sock in his mouth. He went back to Somkid, sodomized her, and then demanded jewelry and money, dragging her around the house by her hair, all while kicking and hitting her. She showed him her secret stash full of valuable jewels, and he then made her swear to Satan that there were no other money or valuables. He then raped her for a third time, and he put all of his findings in a suitcase, left the house, leaving Somkid and her children alive. I hope that's how you say her name, because I've said it so many times, yeah. And if it's not, I really apologize. But once she knew he was gone, she collected her children and called a neighbor. She went to the hospital and had ended up with 2 black eyes, 2 concussions.
That's what it said.
A swollen lip and required 30 stitches to close a gash inside of her mouth. She also gave a great description to the police and worked with a sketch artist, and that sketch was released to the media. Richard's ultimate plan had been to use the money he got from his multiple ransackings to actually buy a torture house. He also believed that the police wouldn't catch him as long as they didn't find any fingerprints, and he was always careful to wear gloves. At this point, there was an $80,000 reward being offered for information on the capture of the Night Stalker.
Which is like the highest reward that had ever been posted for a killer.
Yeah, that's wild. This is also when Frank Salerno called in the FBI's Behavioral Science Unit to help with the profile of their serial killer. The agents from the FBI said that they would do a profile on their killer, but even with all of the serial killers they had interviewed before, this guy was different. He was a first because his MO's always different, his murder weapon's always different, like his victims. He doesn't do the same thing where he only kills within his race or only kills a specific race. He's killing multiple random people. And it's just scary. I think it's scarier that way when you can't find why.
Yeah. The only thing that they said that could have like connected the victims is he usually chose like beige or yellow houses. And so people started painting their houses and stuff.
Yeah. Probably because beige and yellow are just, like, the most common nondescript houses.
Yeah.
You know?
On August 6th, Richard stole yet another Toyota and started driving north. He ended up in Northridge, California. At around 2 a.m., he stopped the car and made his way to the front of a house belonging to Virginia, who is 27, and Chris Peterson, who is 38, and their 5-year-old daughter.
Yeah.
Chris was a large man and worked at a warehouse. Richard found sliding glass doors in the back of the house that were unlocked, entered the house, and found Chris and Virginia's bedroom. Before entering, Richard cocked his gun, which woke up Virginia.
Yeah.
When he walked into the bedroom, Virginia yelled, "Who the hell are you? Get out!" Richard then shot her under the eye with a 25 caliber semi-automatic handgun. Chris woke up, looked at his wife, and Richard shot him in the right temple, knocking him down. Because he was, like, trying to get out of bed.
Yeah.
So, Chris ends up getting up and starts attacking Richard. Richard shot two more times at him, emptying the gun, but missed both shots. The two men fought for a bit, and Richard ended up getting away through the sliding glass doors and took off towards his car. Virginia got up and called 911, and Chris took his daughter and wife in the car and drove to the hospital after being shot in the head.
Yeah, the amount of people who survive getting shot in the head is insane to me.
So, why this happened this particular time?
Yeah.
The ammo that Richard used was very old, so it wasn't as powerful because the gunpowder had been sitting for so long, could have gotten wet.
Fair enough.
Which caused the bullet that hit Chris to literally just bounce off of him.
Holy crap.
Yeah. The bullet that hit Virginia went into her mouth and down her throat and exited out the back of her neck, which, like, missed her brain entirely, even though she was shot in the face.
What the fuck?
And they both survived. The news about the attack on the Petersons was front page news the next day. Richard saw this along with a quote that Salerno said, calling him a coward. Wanting to be protected from the police, Richard bought an Uzi machine gun, which fired 30 rounds per second.
Definitely necessary.
Right? And he also started always carrying a 38 caliber handgun, his 25 caliber automatic, and a pair of handcuffs. Because he knew if he was being caught, he was going down shooting.
Yeah, he was wanting to be taken out by the police, basically. Mm-hmm. On August 8th, he stole another car and began another hunt, making his way to Diamond Bar, California. He chose a house belonging to Sakina and Elias Abowith at around 2:30 a.m. Sakina was a 27-year-old immigrant who worked as a medical technician, and Elias was 31 and originally from Pakistan. He worked as a computer technician. The couple also had two sons, a three-year-old, and a newborn baby who was only 10 weeks old. Richard made his way through the sliding glass door in the back, and he checked out the house, finding the bedroom of the three-year-old first. He then went to the bedroom of the young couple, where the 10-week-old was sleeping in a crib near their bed. He walked up to the sleeping Elias, put the 25 caliber gun right above his ear, and pulled the trigger. This killed him instantly. He jumped on top of Sakina, punching her in the face and stomach. He then handcuffed her and told her not to scream. He blindfolded her with a shirt from the closet and gagged her with part of it, and then tied her ankles together, all while continuously hitting her. He, like, just loves to beat the shit out of people.
Yeah.
He then disabled the phones and started ransacking through their closet. He found their stash of jewelry containing bars of gold, gold bracelets, and rings. He then, again, made her swear to Satan that she wouldn't scream, still hitting and kicking her. He then ripped off her clothes, raping and sodomizing her. The three-year-old boy obviously started crying because he can hear shit going on.
Yeah.
And Richard let Sakina go to him, trying to put him back to sleep. When the boy was back to sleep, he dragged her out of the room and began raping her again. And this is
just
foul, like, but he even drank milk from her breast while raping her. The three-year-old woke up again, walking out to where Richard and Sakina were, saying, "Daddy's not waking up." Richard then brought the boy back to bed, tied him up, and put a pillow over his head. When he finished raping Sakina, he let the mother go to her child and went to the kitchen and came back eating honeydew he found in the fridge, spitting seeds on the floor. Because he just
feels like he can do whatever the fuck he wants.
Yeah, it's like some weird power trip he gets. So let's see. He then blindfolded and gagged her again. And, like, we're saying this all very quickly. Mind you, this is going on for hours in all of these people's homes. He then blindfolded and gagged her again after taking the last of her jewelry. And something fucked up that he was doing this entire time he was, like, raping Sakina and attacking her. He told her that he did not kill her husband and that he had only punched him and knocked him unconscious. And she believed him.
Yeah, because she was like, just, you know, take whatever you want. Just don't kill him. Blah, blah, blah. And he's like, oh, no, I didn't kill him. He's fine.
Yeah, because he's the worst.
Yes.
And before leaving, he gathered all of the belongings in an empty pillowcase and handcuffed Sakina to a door handle. After she was sure Richard was gone, she was able to untie her child after he unsuccessfully tried to wake his father up. He went to the neighbor's house and rang the doorbell. Which, can you imagine, like, a three-year-old showing up on your front door at, like, 3 a.m.?
Yeah, in the book, she said that, like, he didn't want to leave the house because it was nighttime. And she was like, oh, if you go, they'll give you ice cream. And so when he knocked on the door and opened it up, the little boy goes, you have ice cream for me?
That's so sad, but, like, also very wholesome because he had no idea what was going on, which is good, but just fucking terrible. So the neighbors Bob and Rosita Wilson woke up to the doorbell at 3:45 a.m. and found the boy. Bob went with the boy back to his house and found Sakina, giving her a robe to cover up with. Bob then went to Elias and tried to resuscitate him and then realized he was dead. His wife went back to their house and called 911. The police couldn't get the handcuffs off of Sakina and managed to kick the doorknob out so she could go to her husband and children. They eventually were able to use bolt cutters to get the handcuffs off. When she gave a description of the attack to the police, they immediately knew that it was the Night Stalker.
Mm-hmm. So, as they all knew, mm-hmm. Richard was following the media and knew that L.A. County was on the hunt for him.
Yeah, because serial killers are also narcissists and love to watch it.
So he left the area in a stolen Mercedes and made his way to San Francisco. While in San Francisco, he started following an older Asian woman. And when she entered a building, he followed her inside and just, like, knocked her to the ground and started beating the shit out of her. And then just left her in the hallway, not knowing if she was dead or alive.
Just for, like, the shits and giggles, I guess, because he's the worst.
So now he's just, like, going out and doing whatever at any time of the day just to feel some sort of rush is what I feel like.
Yeah, and, like, trying to get as much violence out that he can before he knows he's going to go to jail almost.
Yeah.
Because it's, like, this is when he starts escalating even more, and it's just, like, the murders just keep happening one after another.
So on August 18th, in San Francisco, he entered the home of Barbara and Peter Pan through an open window. Which, Peter Pan, great name.
Great name.
Peter was a 66-year-old accountant, and Barbara was a 62-year-old bank teller. They had immigrated to America in 1969 from Hong Kong. Richard found them sleeping upstairs, walked up to Peter, put the .25 caliber gun to his head, pulled the trigger, killing him instantly.
Yeah. At this point, he's, like, realized, I shouldn't mess around with the husband. Mm-hmm. Just get him out of the way, which is the worst.
Yeah, he figured out his game plan. Yeah. So he hit and sexually assaulted Barbara, but she was resisting him, so he ended up shooting her in the head as well. After ransacking the house, he used lipstick to draw a pentagram and write Jack the Knife on the wall in the bedroom. After leaving the Pan's residence, he picked up a sex worker and paid her $10 to have sex with her feet. And something that I just think is really interesting is when he was with his victims, he never did anything with their feet that we know of. And he was, like, very feet driven with sex workers.
Yeah.
So I don't know if he was just, like, taking advantage of the opportunity with the victims because he knew he had to be fast or something. But I just thought it was, like, something really interesting.
Yeah, it is very strange. Mm-hmm.
So Barbara and Peter's 30-year-old son found them later that morning. His father was dead and Barbara was near death, and he called 911. Carrillo learned of the attack, and after asking the San Francisco police about the specifics, he knew that the Night Stalker had made his way up there. Carrillo and Frank flew up to the scene and returned home after viewing the crime scene and debriefing the police there. The then mayor of San Francisco, Dianne Feinstein, just decided herself to give a press conference about the attack, including information about the ballistics and the avia shoes.
Yeah.
This pissed off the detectives, knowing that the Night Stalker was following the media coverage, and this would give him the perfect opportunity to destroy evidence that he didn't know about.
Yeah, that's why detectives specifically leave out certain information when telling the public about crimes, mm-hmm. so they can have that under their belt.
So Sheriff Block gave his own press conference about it, like talking about how it wasn't right for the mayor to give out that vital information as it would impede their investigation. So I like that they just like stood up to her.
Yeah, they were like, the mayor is fucking wrong. Mm-hmm.
And as they thought, Richard saw the press conference, not realizing he was leaving distinctive shoe prints and ballistic information to connect all of his crimes together. So he just walked to the middle of the Golden Gate Bridge at night and dropped his shoes off into the water below.
Yeah.
He then stayed in San Francisco for a few more days before making his way back to L.A.
So once back in L.A., Richard rented a room in Chinatown. He is not at the Cecil Hotel anymore.
No, he's not.
On August 25th, he stole an orange Toyota and made his way to Mission Viejo, 76 miles south of L.A., the farthest away he had ever traveled for a murder. He went to the house of Bill Carnes, 29, who lived with his fiancée, Carol Smith, 27. He made his way into their home through a window, and when he entered his bedroom, he cocked his .25 caliber gun, which woke Bill up. As Bill got out of bed, Richard shot him, knocking him down, and then Richard shot him twice more in the head. He then discovered Carol and slapped and punched her and made her say that she loved Satan. He continued to beat her while hog-tying her. He then ransacked the apartment and dragged Carol to another room to rape and sodomize her. Prior to raping her, he said, "You know who I am, don't you? I'm the one they're writing about in the newspapers and on TV." He then told her to tell the police that the Night Stalker had been there. Then he left the apartment and went back to the car. So, like, why get rid of the shoe prints if you're literally going to leave a victim alive and tell them the Night Stalker was here? I just don't understand.
It's bizarre.
When Carol knew the attacker was gone, she untied herself and ran to the neighbors to get help. She and Bill were taken to the hospital, where two of the bullets were removed from Bill's head, and he actually ended up surviving his injuries, which is incredible.
Yeah.
While this was happening, a 13-year-old boy named James Romero III was outside working on his motorbike. He saw a strange man in black walking back to his car and had a weird feeling. So he managed to get three numbers of the license plate of the car and wrote them down, as well as the color, make, and model. Richard never saw this boy. He went inside to tell his parents, thinking that it may have been the stalker, and his parents called the police, which, like, fucking love it, man. Can you imagine being 13 and being like, "Oh, I helped catch the Night Stalker"? Right. Like, you would think that, you know? Yeah. That's what I would think.
Like, there were also some places that said that the boy saw this guy creeping around his house, too. Yeah. So there is conflicting evidence, but whatever it is, this 13-year-old boy fucking cracks the case, basically.
Yeah, he was like, "Ooh, I saw him." There was a man named Jesse Perez that met with police saying that he knew of a guy named Rick that he would see often at the bus terminals. Jesse said that Rick was from Texas and matched the description of the Night Stalker, said he was a professional burglar, and had even said that he killed an Asian couple in Monterey Park.
So he also told police of Richard's fence, which we mentioned earlier, Philip Solano. And this is just the guy he used to sell his stolen items to. The police brought Solano in, finding all of the stolen items from the murders in his house, and questioned him. He told them that Rick would call him when he had stuff to sell and that he just moved around to different hotels.
So the police were on the lookout for the orange Toyota that was seen at the Mission Viejo attack, which Richard had already dumped this car. The car was located on August 28th at a shopping center in LA County. And when Richard dumped the car, he thought that he had wiped down all of the fingerprints, and he wore gloves most of the time anyways.
Yeah.
But police were able to find one clear fingerprint on the rearview mirror. The San Francisco police were also working on the investigation now, and they ended up giving a description to the media of all the jewelry that was taken from the last attack. And remember Richard's friend, Donna Myers, from earlier? She had been given some jewelry from her friend Rick, and she gave that jewelry to her daughter. Her daughter, hearing the description of the jewelry on the media, realized that the jewelry she had gotten matched that description, and then kind of thought about it and realized that her mom's friend Rick matched the description of the Night Stalker. So she called it in to the police. The police interviewed her and her husband, who also knew of this Rick, and they thought that it had to be their man. Also, after interviewing one of Donna's friends, they found out that this Rick's last name was Ramirez, because he was the only one who knew his last name. The police also interviewed Donna, who told them that one time, while Rick was at her house, they were just watching TV, and a program about one of the Night Stalker's victims came on. She said that he was very interested in the program, and that he turned to her and said, "Now, wouldn't you be surprised if I turned out to be the stalker?" And she obviously thought that he was joking.
Yeah.
Police also began around-the-clock surveillance on Donna's house, as they now knew that he was a friend of hers and would occasionally stop by. The police then took the fingerprint that they got from the Toyota and ran it against all of the Rick, Richard, and Ricardo Ramirez's in the LA and San Francisco police records. They got a match. Richard Munoz Ramirez. The police station had actually stopped an installation of a new fingerprinting system to search for the Night Stalker's prints, as it was that important. The system went through 380,000 prints to find Richard's, and it ended up only taking 3 minutes to do so. They showed the mugshot of this Richard Ramirez to the guy Jesse, who originally came in with the tip, and he confirmed that that was Rick. So, a press conference was then held where Sheriff Block released Richard's name and mugshot to the media. He said that Richard was a 25-year-old man from El Paso who had a record of petty crimes. Sheriff Block then looked into the camera and said, "We know who you are now, and soon everyone else will. There will be no place you can hide."
And that is where we're leaving part two.
Yes.
Of Richard Ramirez, the Night Stalker. Yeah, hopefully we're done with just pure gore and murder.
Yes.
And now we're on to the exciting capture and trial of Richard Ramirez, basically.
Yeah, because he's fucking nuts. Like, the capture is...
Nope, don't talk about it.
I was just going to say, don't talk
about it. Don't talk about it.
It's crazy.
No.
Crazy.
Don't tell them how crazy it is. They already know. But yes, the capture is super crazy, and we're super excited to cover it.
Yeah.
We hope that you enjoyed this week's episode, and that if you didn't even listen to last week's, that you go back and listen to it, and that you join us next week for episode 3, because it's a 3-parter.
Exactly.
And social medias.
Yes, you can find us on Twitter at Crime Binge, or on Instagram and Facebook at Crime Binge Podcast. And we also have the website, don't forget about that, which is just crimebinge.com.
Yeah, and if you liked this week's episode, make sure you leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you can leave a review.
and keep on binging. Bye.
See ya.